Hello, I am Eli Adachi, professor of medical science at Brown University and host of Medscape One-on-One. Joining me today is Dr. Henry Aaron, the Bruce and Virginia McClory Chair at the Brookings Institution and a veteran health scholar of significant renown. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's plain great to have you.
It's my pleasure.
You recently attended the three-day hearings of the Supreme Court as they related to the Affordable Care Act. Could you perhaps define for our viewers the key issues that were being discussed?
Well, there are a great many issues, and I think their importance far transcends the admittedly extremely important fate of the Affordable Care Act. The major issue on the second day, which was the one that I think got the most attention, is whether the individual mandate, the require that individuals carry approved health insurance, was within the scope of Congress to enact under the interstate commerce, the authority to regulate interstate commerce. Going in, I think a great many people really didn't think this was a terribly close issue, although there had been divided decisions in lower courts. The reason was that the Supreme Court had sustained regulations in situations that were not dramatically different from this. And the sense I felt this from the standpoint of an economist, was that it was so clear that the decision to buy or not to buy insurance had a profound effect on the insurance industry, which Congress can regulate, that in the end it wasn't going to be a close question for most of the justices. How wrong I was. As it turned out, four of the justices pretty clearly were sympathetic with this part of the bill.
This was apparent from their comments.
From their questions to the attorneys for each side. Mm-hmm. Three of them were, two of them who asked questions were very critical of the idea and pretty clearly were going to, I think most observers were not going to support the requirement. Justice Thomas, who is notoriously silent and doesn't ask questions, has a well-established record that placed him in the same camp as those who would oppose the bill. So the two key justices, as it seemed, I think, to many observers, were Justices Kennedy and the Chief Justice Roberts, who seemed leery of the mandate, but not settled in opposition. That was day two. On day three, which in some ways was even more striking, the court had asked for arguments on the question of whether the federal government could extend Medicaid coverage in the way that it does in the law. No lower court had thought this was an issue worth much attention. They had assumed that the federal government had the Congress had the power to do this. But the Supreme Court asked for arguments on it, and from the nature of the questions asked, this issue also seems to be very close. Now, if you put those two issues together, you obviously have at issue a major part, perhaps the major part, of the Affordable Care Act. But you'd also have in play constitutional jurisprudence that could have vast and far-reaching effects way outside the area of healthcare policy regulation or insurance.
In terms of the relative authority of Congress and its ability to, in fact, legislate similar such initiatives.
Yes. For example, the federal government has, in a large number of areas, given money to the states on the condition that they do certain things that Congress wanted them to do.
Along the lines of Medicaid, say.
Well, yes, that was the Medicaid issue, right. But I mean it extends to transportation policy, income support, health, you name it. And if the court should end up placing a limit on the degree to which Congress can leverage state behavior through providing financial incentives, that will ramify throughout domestic policy in the United States.
Recognizing that your background is not legal,
yes.
Nevertheless, as an astute observer, did you feel that the case for the administration was well done or compellingly presented? Or did some of the sense that you brought to this conversation perhaps reflect a relative shortcoming on that end?
Well, I think there are two issues. One can do a kind of critical review of the lawyer's performance in responding, the lawyer's plural response in to the justice's questions. Much more important than that, however, I think is the quality of the briefs that were presented to the court. People who have observed the court, and I'm an amateur, as you correctly point out, are divided as to how important oral arguments are.
Interesting.
There's a lot of feel when you're watching it happen. And in this case, I think there was some disappointment with the way in which the administration's case was presented. But as an economist, rather than as a lawyer, I have to say that my principal reaction was that the questions from the justices reflected a distinct lack of understanding of some pretty basic economics of the healthcare industry.
Which is a fact one essentially had to live with in the context that this transpires.
Well, justices, judges and lawyers in general are not trained in economics any more than economists are trained in law. Mm-hmm. We're amateurs in the other field. Increasingly, law schools include training in basic economics for new students, and so I hold out some hope that the justices' clerks may provide some real assistance here.
I know it's difficult to foresee the future, of course, but as you reflected after the fact, have you formulated in your own mind certain scenarios that might transpire depending on what the decision might in fact be?
That's a good question, and it's one that's almost too good. And the reason is that the number of scenarios is very large.
I suspect
ranging from affirming the whole bill, just as it is, to tossing the whole thing out, which is also not impossible at this point. Mm-hmm. But in between, there are a range of other possibilities, opinions that are very narrowly crafted to deal only with certain points. For example, it might be decided that while the mandate is not acceptable, some or all of the rest of the bill is retained. That was one of the issues that was argued on the final day of arguments, the so-called question of severability. If the mandate is found unconstitutional, does the rest of the bill go with it? Does
right.
some of the rest of the bill go with it? Or does the rest of the bill stand? All three positions were argued. And on this particular issue, I think it's very unclear as to which position will actually prevail. Another question would concern whether, if the individual mandate is sustained, there's some principle that the judges craft that narrowly approves the health mandate, but sends a message that any further extensions of congressional efforts to require behavior under the Interstate Commerce Act are going to be viewed unsympathetically. Again, not directly impacting the health bill, but having very great importance for other social legislation.
Yes. You recently wrote an opinion piece wherein you stated that scrapping the Affordable Care Act would, and I quote, be a prescription for healthcare chaos. Maybe you can expand just for a minute or so on what you meant and what you had in mind at that time.
Well, again, this depends on whether and how all or parts of the bill might be invalidated. If the entire bill, let me start with the simpler case.
Yes.
If the entire bill is invalidated, I think it's very difficult to conceive of an administration, a president, in the foreseeable future of either party wanting to stick his or her neck out very far on health care policy. They will look back and see that President Clinton tried and managed to lose both houses of Congress in the next election, that President Obama tried and, by assumption, the court invalidated it at very considerable political cost, because President Obama really staked a great deal on the passage of this bill. It is the leading domestic piece of legislation of his administration.
Certainly lost the House.
He lost the House, and it would, I think, cast a pall over his reelection efforts. But the main point would be, don't go for the long ball. Don't swing for the fences. Do small things, because if you really take chances and go for large-scale legislative reform in health or anything else, you're exposing yourself to very great danger.
Well said.
So I think this would, if that were to happen, it would stall domestic national policy on health care reform for quite a long time. Now, it's conceivable, were that to happen, or even with more limited negative decision from the court, it's conceivable that an idea that was gaining some currency a few years back could return, which is, all right, we don't do things nationally here, but we do, we'll provide support to the states to undertake reforms. In fact, that's an idea that had some bipartisan support back before President Obama became president, at a time when the prospects for national action seemed extremely remote before. That idea could come back, and it does have precedent north of the border. That, after all, is how the Canadians evolved over time to have the health system they
provincial
now do.
Provincial health systems,
through,
in their case.
Through individual provinces.
Yeah. And you could argue that besides Massachusetts, we obviously have Vermont working on their own plan, and who knows what's next.
Sure, if there were some financial carrots that were given, regulatory flexibility, who knows?
Thank you. To another issue of ongoing currency, because, again, solution may not be imminent, and that is the financing of Medicare. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the general sense is that the future financing of Medicare currently is articulated along two distinct lines. One which, in a sense, is articulated by the Affordable Care Act and the administration, and the other which is articulated by Congressman Paul Ryan, who is the chair of the House Budget Committee, and whose views are distinct and apart from the administration's view. Could you, for the benefit of our viewers, perhaps take a minute or two to compare and contrast these two divergent world visions?
Well, this is an area where the Affordable Care Act is of central importance, and a host of legislation that's going to either expire or come up for renewal at the end of this year. And I think thinking about Medicare requires this larger context. At year end, the Bush-era tax cuts are going to either expire, in which case rates will rise, or get extended in whole or in part. Payroll tax cuts that we've had for the last 2 years will expire. The national debt ceiling is going to have to be raised again. spending cuts that were agreed to by Congress in August of last year and others that occurred automatically when the so-called super committee failed to reach agreement are to take effect. When? January 1st of next year. All of this is occurring at the same time so that the shape of the tax and spending side of the budget are, in a way that is unprecedented in American history, going to be up for grabs. Now, cross that with the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act actually does a great deal to improve the long-term financial prospects of Medicare hospital insurance, the part that everybody talks about as becoming insolvent or running out of money. In fact, if you believe that the Affordable Care Act would remain on the books and be enforced as written, there's very little long-term financial gap left in Medicare Part A hospital insurance. Mm-hmm. Little tiny changes in the benefit side or in taxes, and the system is viable for the indefinite future. If the Affordable Care Act is tossed, then that opens up a much larger financial gap in Medicare hospital insurance. So now enter the disagreement between the visions for Medicare. One vision, the administration's vision, and I think that of most liberals and probably some conservatives in Congress, is to maintain the current defined benefit character of Medicare. There are certain covered services. If their costs go up, basically the risk is shouldered by the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fall on retirees or the disabled. Mm-hmm. The alternative vision, the one that Congressman Ryan is associated with, mm-hmm. says, well, we don't know what's going to happen to future spending, but we think if the risk is shifted to the individual, to the beneficiary, they will become very tough shoppers for health care. They will help hold down the cost, but if they don't, they bear the risk. So the debate is about the financing of Medicare runs along two lines. What's the most effective way to control the growth of spending? Do you use the buying power of a large purchaser like Medicare, or do you rely on individual insurance shoppers? And on the other hand, if we fail to control the growth of healthcare spending, who gets stuck with the cost? Mm-hmm. Those are pretty fundamental differences in points of view. By and large, conservatives argue for the individual shopper and have said that they want the risk to lie with the beneficiary. Political liberals, progressives in the modern mm-hmm. parlance, have argued that the defined benefit character was important because it kept risk on the away from a vulnerable population, and they believe, and I think I have to say I believe, that the more effective way of controlling spending would be to use the buying clout that Medicare has.
It probably should be pointed out that at least the most recent version of the Ryan plan at least includes as an option for consumers, Medicare as we knew it, amongst the various
if it remains viable over time.
Right.
The most recent version, namely the version that Congressman Ryan and Senator Ron Wyden, right. a Democrat from Oregon, signed on to, is still in such embryonic form. The details are not specified. The details are everything. And I personally am skeptical that when they get to writing legislative language, they're going to be able to find language that both Senator Wyden and Congressman Ryan can embrace.
Interesting. Thank you. Perhaps we should move now to Medicaid, which is the other all-important entitlement that everybody is struggling to finance in a way that would hopefully be workable for all involved. Mm-hmm. Here again, there appear to be two very divergent points of view. There is, on the one hand, the Affordable Care Act with the expansion of Medicaid, with the incorporation of a large segment of the uninsured population into the mix. on the one hand, and on the other hand, yet again, a conservative position that favors a very different approach that tends to favor block grants and state control as distinct to the previous federal-state partnership. How does a seasoned health economist like you think about these two options, and what can you say to our viewers to make them see perhaps the strengths and weaknesses of either one of those positions?
If one's objective is to cap or limit the federal budgetary cost of Medicaid, block granting is the way to go. But there are, I believe, other objectives that are at least as important and, I would argue, more important. One of the functions of Medicaid has been to act as an element not just of the social safety net, but as what we economists call an automatic stabilizer, something when spending in the economy at large goes down, unemployment goes up, what comes in and picks up the slack? Well, we know unemployment insurance does that for the people who lose work. They get cash from the state unemployment insurance funds. But so does Medicaid. And the reason that works that way is that enrollments in Medicaid go up, expenditures because, on behalf...
Right, because eligibility is poverty-driven.
Well, it's not just poverty-driven, it's unemployment-driven. When people lose their work, they lose their income, they can very easily become eligible for Medicaid. And so the program provides a very important protection during time of need, not just for the beneficiaries directly, but for the economy at large, because spending goes up. Now, if you move to a block grant, that second function goes away, and the reason is you have capped federal spending. So if unemployment goes up, state revenues go down, more applicants come in for Medicaid, but the state revenues are declining, we know from historical experience the reaction of states in that circumstance. If funding is limited, and even to a degree under Medicaid, is to cut back on eligibility.
And on benefits. And on
benefits. On the generosity of benefits as well. So one of the issues here is what do you lose in the way of protection at time of greatest need for the people who are Medicaid eligible?
Right.
Now, again, there are conflicting objectives here. Fiscal probity and parsimony is a virtue not to be dismissed, but protection for vulnerable populations, in my view, is what the program is about, and I think the block granting of Medicaid would sacrifice a large part of that purpose of the program.
Thank you. Our viewers who are providers are obviously interested on an ongoing basis in the ultimate solution to particularly Medicare reimbursement as determined by the current formula, which has yet to be permanently fixed. What is your sense, having observed this now, I'm certain, for a number of years, what is your sense in terms of how this will ultimately play out and when?
I don't know. And the reason I say that is, on the one hand, I don't think there is any responsible observer, conservative or liberal, who thinks that the fee cuts called for by the sustainable growth rate formula are actually going to be imposed this year, next year, or ever. They're just, it's not going to happen.
Because they're only going to grow, obviously, in time.
Well, fees are going to grow. They've actually been pretty flat for quite a while under Medicare. But the idea that we would cut them 28-30%, it's not going to happen. for reasons of substance and politics. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do we get out of this situation? The simplest thing would be to say, all right, we made a mistake. We're going to renormalize the fee structure to where it is, and we're going to have some kind of an arrangement going from here. But that sensible course of action would require Congress to record the additional cost that it would have to take account of for not cutting fees 28% or 30%. Mm-hmm. And that's like a $300 billion hit to the budget over the next decade. No member of Congress really wants to do that. So they keep delaying things. The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, a congressionally created organization of experts to provide advice to Congress, has suggested that a modest cut in fees for specialists be put into effect, but that fees be maintained at current levels for primary care specialties and general practitioners. Mm-hmm. The reason? It has the effect of achieving some savings, of not costing what it would cost to recognize the failure of the sustainable growth rate formula, and simultaneously it changes the relative remuneration in a direction that many observers now think the fee structure should change. That as the population ages, increasing awareness of the services people that really make a difference in people's lives becomes apparent, we should increase the relative remuneration of primary care and encourage more doctors to go into those fields. But we're still a long, long way from getting to an agreement, which is why I said I don't know at the outset.
But not this year, by every indication that we know of.
We will probably kick the can down the road another year.
Before we conclude, if I may just ask you for your thoughts about healthcare under President Romney, should he be elected. What will the scene be like?
I will resist the facetious response brought up by his campaign manager's reference to the Etch-a-Sketch, but I really don't know. Anybody running for a nomination afresh in either party, and emphatically in the Republican Party today, has to secure the support of the constituency that votes in primaries. That's a different constituency from the one that elects the president. And of necessity, there is a difference in emphasis in the case that one makes to those two different groups. So without suggesting fickleness or improper change of position, it's entirely natural that candidate Romney candidate for the nomination Romney, yes, is going to take a different position than candidate for the president Romney. Yes. And both are going to be different from the position that a president Romney would take confronted with the realities of budgetary pressures, of needing to deal with the states, and of the need to take ownership politically and from a policy standpoint of the measures that are going to be undertaken in his administration. Early on in the campaign, Mr. Romney indicated that if he became president, he would create a state option under the Affordable Care Act. That if a state wanted to remain under it, it could. If it didn't, it didn't have to. That view has vanished. He's emphasized his opposition to the bill law as a whole. But any president who comes into office, any Republican president who comes into office, faces a very difficult choice. If I get rid of the Affordable Care Act, if the Supreme Court hasn't done it already, right, but if through political measures I basically walk away from the Affordable Care Act, I own all the problems of the U.S. healthcare system. the likelihood that more and more people are going to be uninsured, the likelihood that costs are going to continue to rise, they're my responsibility. So I think there's going to be an effort to try to mute that. And that may involve an attempt to retain some elements of the Affordable Care Act or to reenact them if they have been invalidated.
I will close on a personal note, if I may, by pointing out that you have joined the Brookings Institution back in 1968.
Yes.
And in the ensuing 44 years, you have dedicated yourself to the study of healthcare and healthcare policy, and of course, healthcare economics. What would you say were the seminal influences or events that really are responsible for the choice you made and the longevity of your interest?
Actually, when I came to Social Security, I was interested primarily in Social Security and public finance issues, taxation. In 1977, I got a job in what was then called the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare because of a little pamphlet I had written on welfare reform. So no health up to this point. In the course of a couple of years working at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, it became crystal clear to me that healthcare policy was going to be the dominant social policy concern in the years ahead. And I was having a conversation with a very old friend to this day, Joe Newhouse, who is at Harvard University and basically organizes a lot of healthcare policy work there, and I said this. And he acted as a marriage broker and put me in contact with a physician, William Schwartz, then at Tufts New England Medical Center. And that started a partnership between the two of us that lasted quite a long time and was the beginning of my work on healthcare policy. It was very productive, and one thing that I learned is that if you're an economist working on healthcare policy and you think you can do it alone, you're wrong. It is vitally important that people trained in medicine be around the table all the time in the development of healthcare policy. Yes, economists have a lot to contribute, but this isn't a one-discipline job.
It might be worth pointing out that Bill Schwartz was chair of medicine at the New England Medical Center at Tufts Medical School, a noted nephrologist, and that we have lost him, I believe, about a year ago now. He's no longer with us.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And on this note, sincere thanks to Dr. Aaron and to you, our viewers, for joining Medscape One-on-One. Until next time, I am Eli Adashi.